And the same queer combination of sagacity and aggressive selfishness that had distinguished the war of her orders at home and enabled her population to worry out a balance of power without any catastrophe marks her policy abroad. She understood the value of allies. She would assimilate. Abroad, as at home, she could in those days at least give and take with a certain fairness and sanity. There lay the peculiar power of Rome. By that it was she succeeded where Athens, for example, had conspicuously failed. The Athenian democracy suffered much from that narrowness of patriotism which is the ruin of all nations. Athens was disliked and envied by her own empire because she dominated it in a spirit of civic egotism. Her disasters weren't felt and shared as disasters by her subject cities. The shrewder, nobler Roman senators of the great years of Rome, before the First Punic War, overstrained her moral strength and began her degeneration, were not only willing in the last resort to share their privileges with the mass of their own people, but eager to incorporate their sturdiest antagonists upon terms of equality with themselves. They extended their citizenship, cautiously but steadily. Some cities became Roman, with even a voting share in the government. Others had self-government and the right to trade or marry in Rome without full Roman citizenship. Garrisons of full citizens were set up at strategic points, and colonies with variable privileges established amidst the purely conquered peoples. The need to keep communications open in this great and growing mass of citizenship was evident from the first. Printing and paper weren't yet available for intercourse, but a system of high roads followed the Latin speech and the Roman rule. The first of these, the Appian Way, ran from Rome ultimately into the heel of Italy. It was begun by the censor, Appius Claudius, who mustn't be confused with the decemvir, Appius Claudius, of a century earlier, in 312 BC. According to a census made in 265 BC, there were already in the Roman dominions, that's to say in Italy south of the Arno, 300,000 citizens. They all had a common interest in the welfare of the state. They were all touched a little with the diffused kingship of the Republic. This was, we have to note, an absolutely new thing in the history of mankind. All considerable states and kingdoms and empires hitherto had been communities by mere obedience to some head, some monarch, upon whose moods and character the public welfare was helplessly dependent. No republic had hitherto succeeded in being anything more than a city-state. The so-called Athenian Empire was simply a city-state directing its allies and its subjugated cities. In a few decades, the Roman Republic was destined to extend its citizenship into the valley of the Po, to assimilate the kindred Gauls, replacing their language by Latin, and to set up a Latin city, Aquileia, at the very head of the Adriatic Sea. In 89 BC, all free inhabitants of Italy became Roman citizens. In 212 AD, the citizenship was extended to all free men in the empire. This extraordinary political growth was manifestly the precursor of all modern states of the Western type. It's as interesting to the political student, therefore, as a carboniferous amphibian or an archaeopteryx to the student of zoological development. It's the primitive type of the now dominant order. Its experiences throw light upon all subsequent political history. One natural result of this growth of a democracy of hundreds of thousands of citizens scattered over the greater part of Italy was the growth in power of the Senate. There had been in the development of the Roman constitution a variety of forms of the popular assembly, the plebeian assembly, the assembly by tribes, the assembly by centuries, and the like, into which variety we can't enter here with any fullness. But the idea was established that with the popular assembly lay the power of initiating laws. It's to be noted that there was a sort of parallel government in this system. The assembly by tribes or by centuries was an assembly of the whole citizen body, patrician and plebeian together. The assembly of the plebeians was, of course, an assembly only of the plebeian class. Each assembly had its own officials, the former, the consuls, and so on, the latter, the tribunes. While Rome was a little state, 20 miles square, it was possible to assemble something like a representative gathering of the people, but it'll be manifest that with the means of communicating existing in Italy at that time, it was now impossible for the great bulk of the citizens even to keep themselves informed of what was going on at Rome, much less to take any effective part in political life there. Aristotle, in his Politics, had already pointed out the virtual disenfranchisement of voters who lived out of the city and were preoccupied with agricultural pursuits, and this sort of disenfranchisement by mechanical difficulties applied to the vast majority of Roman citizens. With the growth of Rome, an unanticipated weakness crept into political life through these causes, and the popular assembly became more and more a gathering of political hacks and the city riffraff, and less a representation of the ordinary worthy citizens. The popular assembly came nearest to power and dignity in the 4th century BC. From that period it steadily declined in influence, and the new Senate, which was no longer a patrician body with a homogeneous and on the whole a noble tradition, but a body of rich men, ex-magistrates, powerful officials, bold adventurers, and the like, pervaded by a strong disposition to return to the idea of hereditary qualification, became for 3 centuries the ruling power in the Roman world. There are 2 devices since known to the world which might have enabled the popular government of Rome to go on developing beyond its climax in the days of Appius Claudius the censor at the close of the 4th century BC, but neither of them occurred to the Roman mind. The first of these devices was a proper use of print. In our account of early Alexandria, we've already remarked upon the strange fact that printed books didn't come into the world in the 4th or 3rd century BC. This account of Roman affairs forces us to repeat that remark. To the modern mind, it's clear that a widespread popular government demands, as a necessary condition for health, a steady supply of correct information upon public affairs to all the citizens and a maintenance of interest. The popular governments in the modern states that have sprung up on either side of the Atlantic during the last 2 centuries have been possible only through the more or less honest and thorough ventilation of public affairs through the press. But in Italy, the only way in which the government of Rome could communicate with any body of its citizens elsewhere was by sending a herald, and with the individual citizen it could hold no communication by any means at all. The second device, for which the English are chiefly responsible in the history of mankind, which the Romans never used, was the almost equally obvious one of representative government. For the old popular assembly, in its threefold form, it would have been possible to have substituted a gathering of delegates. Later on in history, the English did, as the state grew, realize this necessity. Certain men, the knights of the shire, were called up to Westminster to speak and vote for local feeling, and were more or less formally elected for that end. The Roman situation seems, to a modern mind, to have called aloud for such a modification. It was never made. The method of assembling the Comitia Tributa, one of the 3 main forms of the popular assembly, was by the proclamation of a herald, who was necessarily inaudible to most of Italy, 17 days before the date of the gathering. The augurs, the priests of divination, whom Rome had inherited from the Etruscans, examined the entrails of sacrificial beasts on the night before the actual assembly, and, if they thought fit to say that these gory portents were unfavourable, the Comitia Tributa dispersed. But if the augurs reported that the livers were propitious, there was a great blowing of horns from the capital and from the walls of the city, and the assembly went on. It was held in the open air, either in the little forum beneath the capital, or in a still smaller recess opening out of the forum, or in the military exercising ground, the Campus Martius, now the most crowded part of modern Rome, but then an open space. Business began at dawn with prayer. There were no seats, and this probably helped to reconcile the citizen to the rule that everything ended at sunset.